Good day, this is Dimitri Lascaris coming to you for Reason to Resist on March 11th, 2026 from Montreal, Canada. Is Western society collapsing, and if so, will it take the rest of humanity down with it? Today we'll explore this and other existential questions with Indy Samarajiva. Indy is a writer based in Sri Lanka. It surprised me that he's actually blogging on his own site and doesn't do that on Substack. Now, one subject about which Indy writes extensively is societal collapse. Because he himself has lived through more than one. And this is the first time we've had him on Reason to Resist. We're very happy to have him here today. And thank you for joining us, Indy.
Thank you for having me, Dimitri.
I'd like to begin with your background. You were born in Canada, as I understand it, and raised in the United States in Ohio.
Yeah. And my parents were academics. So as they studied and taught, I moved around with them.
And as an adult, you made the interesting decision to move to Sri Lanka from North America. I think what can fairly be said to be economic reasons, the human traffic between Sri Lanka and North America generally moves in the direction of North America. But you made a different choice as an adult. You decided to leave the relative prosperity and security of this place and go to Sri Lanka. Could you explain to us why you made that decision?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So on one level, I was honestly depressed in the West. I couldn't put my finger on why, but there was something sort of depressing about it. And the other reason was I always thought that the future was in Asia somehow. And I wanted to go to some place where things were happening. I don't know if I was right, but actually, I think the future is in Asia, not in the way I thought. But for some reason, I thought that the future wasn't. I mean, they say go West, young man. It didn't seem to make sense to me. So I went East.
Right. And have you, I know these are big questions and probably involve a lot of personal sort
no,
of details.
Please, I'm happy to talk about myself. Carry on.
have you come to the conclusion, at least at this point in time, that that was a wise decision?
Yeah, I think so. So I talked about how I felt depressed. I think there's a lot of feeling that something is sort of generally or societally wrong, in the West, that there's a sort of lack of human connection and a sort of loneliness. I'm not saying for everybody, let's just say I felt that. And then when I came back here, that feeling slowly went away. Now I kind of wish people would leave me alone, but it's like where I live, we're surrounded by family. I actually can't get away from them. We're surrounded by kids, by older people. It's more of a connected life. And I think people don't talk about it, but migrating, it's always portrayed as migrating for a better life, right? Going to Canada or going to America or going west, basically. But it's actually kind of a tragedy. People leave their homes, they leave their culture, they leave their food, they leave their families. Not only that, they leave their old people behind. People leave their parents here in Sri Lanka, for example, and then their parents get old and kind of die without their children around, which for us culturally, and I think humans generally, is a sort of tragic thing. Immigration is portrayed as this better life thing. And I don't think it is. I think it can be, but I think it's a kind of a destruction. It's all predicated on life being worse here, right? Mm-hmm. So the whole system is designed to kind of make life worse here so that we become the next wave of colonizers for colonized land. And I think there's sort of a trauma there, which I didn't understand at the time. I just felt like something was off. But I think there's a trauma in Western society, even, let's say, white people. I mean, that's a moving category, right? But let's say Irish, Italian, they would have, English, European, they would have left homes and cultures and gone on a very uncomfortable journey and then had to do terrible things and go through trauma to create this better life. And I think it's kind of a traumatic process. I didn't think about it at the time, but I think it took me a while to heal from that. But I feel like I'm better now.
As a child of immigrants, I wholeheartedly agree with your sentiments. So let's move on to the question of collapse. That's something that you, you've lived through apparently more than once. Can you talk to us about that experience and
So I can talk about the most proximate example, which is probably the most relevant. So let's say, I think it was 2022, forgive my years. But Sri Lanka, basically the ratings agencies cut our ratings and Sri Lanka effectively defaulted on debt. And because we're in the petrodollar system, what that meant immediately was a loss of energy. So, yeah, I remember there, I mean, there were petrol queues, the queues, you would wait in queues for like 4 hours. A lot of our cooking is done through natural gas. That was unavailable. So you saw people gathering firewood again, and you could just see what happened without energy. And I think that's relevant now because as the Strait of Hormuz gets selectively shut, it's hitting Sri Lanka, not quite yet, but it's hitting Bangladesh already. It's hitting India. It's hitting everybody. And you can see how much everyone depends on fossil fuels and how much, like how quickly your society can fall apart. Because we had power cuts for up to, I remember we put a 12-hour power cut. And after that, everybody was so angry that everybody was out in the streets. And then we kind of like overthrew that government, but then we got put under IMF administration, which we elected a nominally communist government, but we're under that now. But yeah, I guess I have some familiarity with, you don't realize how much you depend on energy flows and water coming out of the tap and lights going on and fans and air conditioning and cars and all that stuff can go away. All that stuff is, it just comes on a ship. It comes on a ship for almost all of us. And those ships go through a sort of 20-mile strait. And if that gets shut down, things can get, they can get real pretty fast.
Yeah. Can you imagine if the energy gluttons and the water gluttons of the West were suddenly without those things? That would be quite a shock to their system.
One thing I say about Sri Lanka, like there's this joke in The Sopranos. It's a Russian telling it to Tony Soprano. And she says, like, that's the problem with you Americans. You're like, you're not used. You expect everything to go right. And then when something goes slightly wrong, you're quite confused. Whereas like we other people, we always expect stuff to go wrong and we're not disappointed. Right. So yes, Sri Lankans are like, we've been through like a 30-year civil war as well. So certainly people in the north, and then also they suppressed like a sort of communist revolution in the south. So people have been through some stuff. But then we're a bit more resilient in that way. I think Western societies are a bit fragile, but I hope they get to experience it. God knows they deserve it.
We'll come back to that in a moment. I wanted to ask you, because you referred to Sri Lanka's nominally communist government, that's how you described it. Has recently done something which I think has attracted the admiration of many people around the world, at least those who are anti-imperialist in their perspective, but has provoked the ire of the United States, namely 1 week ago, a U.S. submarine torpedoed an Iranian frigate, the Dena, about 19 nautical miles off Sri Lanka's southern port city of Galle. As our audience knows, I'm sure, that treacherous attack killed dozens of sailors on this unarmed frigate. It was carrying about 180 crew members, was part of a multinational naval exercise hosted by India, which did nothing, along with the United States, to rescue the Iranian sailors who survived the blast. But the government of Sri Lanka sent help and managed to rescue a few dozen, I believe. So, I've been reading reports that after Sri Lanka did that, the Trump regime pressured it to not to repatriate the survivors to Iran. And the government apparently has resisted that pressure. Now, as far as I know, no Western government condemned the barbarism of the U.S. military. Neither did India, even though it had hosted this vessel. So could you talk to us about this incident? And why did this government, which you consider to be nominally communist, stand up to the Trump regime? And what do you think more broadly this incident says about Western values?
I think it's the bare minimum. So under the Geneva Conventions, if you attack a ship, even if you attack a ship in war, you're supposed to rescue the survivors. That's quite clear in the Geneva Conventions. And Sri Lanka, as a non-party to this conflict, our duty is even more clear. Like if someone is drowning, we should help them. And we've had friendly relations with Iran for a long time. What makes me very angry is that they're very proud of what they did. They advertise, they show, I haven't watched the video because it scares me. So Sri Lanka, you're never more than like an hour or two from the ocean, really, or let's say three. But I spend a lot of time in the ocean, but I'm scared of it. I've been in the deep ocean, I've been diving and so on, and it's just a crazy feeling because it's kind of like all the way down and all the way around and you're all alone out there. And that's one of the ways of dying that really scares me. And to do that to another human being, to a group of human beings, and watch, I don't know, that's something gone terribly wrong in your soul. So even the Nazis in World War II, so there, until a certain incident, which America was involved in, I think was called the Laconia or something. So in the, I think it's the Laconia, please correct me, but the Nazis torpedoed a ship, but then they went and rescued the survivors. And then as a U-boat, they surfaced and they kept the survivors on top. An American plane saw this and pointed out that this is a U-boat, and then they sunk it with the survivors. And after that, the Nazis then gave an order. I think it's like Donitz order. Donitz gave something like the Laconia order. And after that, there wasn't any more of that saving survivors stuff. But for a long time, that was, and for a very good reason, all the Geneva Conventions there are there to protect your own people. But I think what we're discovering is Geneva Conventions, laws of war, these apply within European nations, within white people. And they consider us savages. And they can kill us and bomb our schools. And sing. And so this was not a warship. This ship had gone out for a ceremonial thing before the war started. I think there was a marching band on board. As far as I know, they were unarmed. But what is good is we took the people in, and the community, so this is in Galle in South Sri Lanka, the community fed them and brought them clothes, and the community crowdfunded to get freezer space to preserve the bodies. And to just treat them with like human decency as we would want our own people to be treated. And there just is no decency towards us. And I say us to include Iranians. Sri Lanka's in a weird position, right? We can't really get involved. We're kind of poor, but we still have some human duty to each other. And yeah, Sri Lanka's not, I wouldn't say it's on the side of the resistance, but I'd say I think we should be.
Well, that was my next question, in fact, because I understand the government, in the course of resisting this pressure from the Trump regime, has stated that its position with respect to this war is one of neutrality. Do you think that that ought to be its position? And if not, what do you, realistically speaking, given the economic wherewithal of the country and geopolitical circumstances it confronts geopolitically, realistically speaking, what do you think it can and should do vis-a-vis this war?
Realistically speaking, I think, so look, even Iran wasn't in a rush to get into this war, even despite what was happening in Palestine. And as deeply as I know that they cared about it, they still had a responsibility to their own people. And they entered the war when it became a war of self-defense. Sri Lanka's responsibility to its own people and also what we could possibly contribute. I think people are just trying to keep their head down. A lot of countries are trying to keep their head down. And if you're going to lift your head up, you need to have a multi-generational plan to do that. And I mean, one of the things I worry about is when independence happened, like in 1948 for everybody, there were some people that fought for it and there are some people that didn't. So China fought for it. In India, for example, not as much as in, you could say it was non-violently, but they didn't really fight for it. I mean, and Sri Lanka also didn't fight for it. We just kind of got our independence as a corollary to India getting it. And then those countries, like if you don't fight for something, sometimes you don't have it. So if you don't fight for independence, you sometimes don't have it. And we don't really have independence. If you look at India now, can you say they're independent? Like America is dictating their energy policy to them. It's quite shameful to them. With the sinking situation, Sri Lanka was closer. Like, we should have saved those people. Like, we were the closer party. And India has helped us many times when we needed help. India's Coast Guard, and whenever we have floods or typhoons, whatever, India does help us. And I'm grateful for that. But what India did, I don't think they even sent a message to the Iranians. And in Asian culture, there's a concept of hospitality. And if someone comes to my house, and then another house guest, I think America was at this thing, like, shoots them on the way out, that reflects badly on me. And I think it does reflect badly on India. India, I think, has more ability to move in this situation, but I think they've completely lost the plot as well. Like, if you look at the history, like all of these, Sri Lanka and India were part of the non-aligned movement. So that's kind of where we naturally gravitate. Like when it was the Soviets versus the US, we tried to stay out of it. I think, quite idly, not having people I'm responsible for, I think we should have taken the side of the Soviets. And I think we should take the side of the resistance now. But when you have 20 million people depending on you, I think you'd make different decisions.
So about a week before this treacherous incident, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi went to a genocidal Israeli entity and fawned all over the committer of this crime in the Israeli Knesset, after which the Speaker of the Knesset conferred upon him what I call the gold medal of depravity. And this was only one or two days before Israel and the United States launched this latest criminal war of aggression on the Islamic Republic. You know, we've heard a lot of chatter over the past few years about BRICS and BRICS delivering humanity from the scourge of Western imperialism. Iran is a member of BRICS, as is India, core member, as a matter of fact. What do you think these events, not just, you know, Modi's visit to Israel on the eve of the war of aggression on Iran, but also the incident off the coast of Sri Lanka, what do you think it says about BRICS? Is it a marriage of convenience whose members will compromise on the question of Western aggression when they deem it politically expedient to do so? Or do you think that this is a harbinger of a better time for humanity?
Well, India is definitely the weak link in BRICS. India's policy under Modi has been trying to play all sides and basically piss everybody off. I think you have to understand the subcontinental sort of position within colonialism, which hasn't really changed much. The face of colonialism for a long time would have looked like someone like me. Like India was administered through brown people, and even a lot of Africa was administered through brown people. And we sort of supply labor. There was Indian labor that came down to Sri Lanka to do the tea plantations and so on. And right now there's a lot of Indian labor in the Gulf, millions of people. And there's, after Al-Aqsa flood, Palestinians got kicked. They depend on the Palestinian labor force. Those people got kicked off, and they got replaced with Indians. And I know it got replaced with Sri Lankans. So we basically send people over there in very bad conditions. But then we get some foreign currency back. That's how colonialism still operates. I say that India supplies coolies to the Middle East, and then it supplies cyber coolies to the West itself. But we end up supplying labor. And in Israel, they talk quite openly about that. They were saying that the fact that U.S. air defenses failed, this is on Israeli TV, they said, the U.S. air defenses failed, we're going to get a lot of orders. But someone else was like, how do we produce them? And then the other person was like, but we have India now. We'll use India as a labor force. Mm-hmm. And there was always this cynical selling out of elites to sell the labor of people like them to get money. And you can kind of do an economy that way, but is that a real economy? But that's still what's happening. And that's still the deal that they're trying to play. But obviously it's blowing up in their face, because what Iran's doing now is saying, like, you know, it's not just the people that do good and are independent that will suffer. Now, like, if we're going to suffer, everybody's going to suffer. And one thing people aren't talking about I'm sorry to jump topics. One thing people aren't talking about with the war now is the guys on those ships, a lot of them are brown. Like, a lot of them are people who look like me. There are a lot of them are Indians or Bangladeshis or Sri Lankans or Pakistanis. And in the UAE, in those countries, a lot of the people who can't get out, whose passports are held under the Hawala system, are brown people. So at some level, we never became independent, and we got sucked right back into the colonial labor system. And as that empire goes down, it's falling down on us.
Yeah. When you say those ships, I take it you're referring to the oil tankers that are passing or were passing the Strait of Hormuz. Right. So you I think, can fairly be described as, like us, as unapologetic about your support for the resistance in West Asia to U.S. hegemony. And as we discuss a lot on this channel, the groups in that region almost entirely, I can think of maybe one exception, that resist in a physical way Western domination of their homeland are characterized as terrorist entities by Israel, the United States, and their so-called allies. How do you respond to the allegation that groups like Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps engage in terrorism?
Well, I think one thing that's important for people to understand is that in most of the world, they are not designated terrorist organizations. So in Sri Lanka, I actually have like Hamas and Hezbollah like patches on my backpack or whatever. It's not an illegal organization here. Whereas in Sri Lanka, let's say the LTT, which we consider a terrorist organization in Sri Lanka, that's not a terrorist organization in the UK. There's a sort of myopic view that if, you know, honestly, the worst people on earth designate something terrorist, then it becomes terrorist. But in most of the world, no, these are not terrorist organizations. Mm-hmm. And you can really just look, I don't think it's an academic debate. Just look at their behavior over the past 2 years. Who's blowing up hospitals? Who's blowing up schools? Who's the whole definition of terrorism is almost predicated on this idea that colored people can't feel terror, that we don't have feelings, that terror is only like a white feeling, and terror really extends to sort of inconvenience. Like even with the reason for attacking Iran, it's, oh, they might think they might potentially have a nuke later. Like Israel already has nukes, but just the fear inside the white mind is construed as terror. And then that excuses any level of savagery towards other people. But I'm telling you, like the world is bigger than, I call it the white empire, because just in my writing, I got tired of saying, oh, America and the UK and Israel and the UAE and just all these commas. As a writer, I abhor lengthy sentences. And I just said, okay, it's the white empire. And if like that bothers you as a white person, I'm like, I don't identify as brown for the purpose of like robbing Botswana. Like just, you can just be something else, be like Greek or even Canadian. I think that's a bit sus, but like, it's a weird identity, which really only has white supremacy at the core of it. There's no food. There's no particular culture anyway, but let's just say that term. And now I forgot what I was talking about. Sorry.
Well, let me give you a specific example on this whole question of terrorism. By the way, I think we should just ban the word from our language because it's been put to such nefarious uses by Western elites, by the white empire, as you call it. But right now, we've seen images, those of us who are paying attention, of these extraordinarily sophisticated Iranian missiles, I think called the Khorramshahr 4, which are described by, you know, the corporate media in the West as cluster bombs or cluster missiles. And apparently they, after traveling at hypersonic speeds and entering the atmosphere, they release up to 80 submunitions. And we've seen these videos of these coming down, dozens of these warheads coming down on some particular target. And so we've been allowed to see images of these things, I think, because they advance this narrative in the corporate media that Iran targets civilians and civilian infrastructure. We'll never see the effects of these things on any military targets in Israel, not if the genocidal regime can help it. So how would you respond, for example, to the claim that those things are targeting civilians, those Khorramshahr 4 missiles?
Let me think about that.
Or maybe not targeting, but indiscriminately causing harm to civilian areas of the country.
So I think, look, in the 12-day war, Iran was very methodical, really about sort of like threat signaling. Like I think at one point, I think it was Ramon Air Base, but they hit like the officer's swimming pool. Or they take great care to make these sort of targeted missiles. So the United States policy since World War II has been what they call strategic bombing. It just really means carpet bombing. So just burn everything to the ground and like terrify people. That's the basic policy. I think Iran, perhaps because they didn't have the luxury of infinite bombs very far from their home. And also because they are an Islamic republic and Islam requires only defensive warfare and has to be proportional. And if someone proposes peace to you, you have to listen to them. I think they're actually moral fighters and they're not trying to terrorize the population. And Iran's strategy is very clear and they've laid it out very clearly, which is they're taking out the radar stations that enable Israel and the United States to attack them. And they're taking out the military bases and the military positions that enable the white empire to attack them. And that's fairly Clausewitzian sort of doctrine of war. You're trying to disarm the other person. Everything they're doing is towards disarming the other person. So if you talk about, say, cluster munitions. So what you see on those videos, I think some of those, if you see them, those are actually sort of flares to, like, to distract the air defenses. So what that missile is trying to do is get through the air defenses to hit its target. So it, everything Iran is doing is towards disarming the aggressive empire, which is attacking them, which has attacked Iraq, which has attacked Syria, which attacks Lebanon on the daily basis, and which is still exterminating the largest open-air concentration camp in Gaza. Mm-hmm. So that's what they're doing. And look, at this point, if you're... I used to spend a fair bit of time on explaining what's happening in the mass media to people, but I don't anymore, because if they've lied to you about genocide, if they've lied to you about, I think this is the, I don't know, in my lifetime, this must be like the fifth war that they've lied to you, to us about, maybe just don't go back to that as a source. and I would say read Iran directly. Like, just listen to the statements from their... So their generals and their leaders come out and they make statements which are rational and reasonable, and you can evaluate with your own mind. And I wouldn't take advice from people who are frankly inciting genocide. And I wouldn't take judgment from them, certainly.
And so one line of argument we hear from some constituency in the anti-imperialist movement, we hear them say things like, I condemn both the government of Iran and Israel and the United States. How do you respond to that line of argument?
I think these are people who they sort of piously cross themselves out and they make themselves completely useless. I think what they say is neutrality in the time of whatever oppression sides with the oppressor. And then Martin Luther King, when he was in Birmingham jail, talked about how, you know, the condemnation of white moderates was what disappointed him the most. This is not a case of sort of holding your nose and supporting Iran or holding your nose and supporting the resistance. I invite you to read the resistance people directly. I invite you to read their statements. I invite you to read their philosophy. And for the Islamic resistance, I invite you to read the Quran. These are people with a coherent philosophy, with a moral philosophy, and they don't have the same propaganda arm as the West, but you can see by their deeds what they do. You can see that they're not targeting school children. You can see that they're not, don't have a target list of hospitals at the top. You can see that they're in their land trying to defend their land. You can see that Iran is the only country in the world, shout out Yemen, like for that half the country, but the only country in the world that did their duty under the Genocide Convention, which is not to sit around and make statements and write books about it, but it is your duty to go and stop it and to support armed resistance against it, which is what they have done. And they've taken nothing but punishment for that. So these are good people. These are inspirational people. And again, when the empire condemns something, I used to be inside and I used to believe them. But at some point, I started taking their condemnations as reading recommendations. So I would read the people they condemned. And I'd be like, oh, these people actually care about the poor. Or they care about protecting their own people. Or they have some moral philosophy which isn't about just making money and stepping on people. Or they just want to be free and independent. And it's not a case of holding your nose and supporting the resistance. These people are able to fight this way because they are moral, because they are fighting a good fight, because they have faith, because they believe in God, because they believe in something bigger than themselves. And at this point, right, I used to make this used to be a hard argument to make. At this point, come on. At this point, the empire, they're fairly open pedophiles and thieves, and they're quite openly corrupt. So what are we even talking about here? And their media and academia and all these wishy-washy people, they're on that same side. With the Epstein stuff, you can see the corruption that runs all the way through. So I think we've got to stop taking words from these people, like terrorism, and we've got to stop taking judgment on like who's good or bad from people that are obviously evil. And yeah, I don't hold my nose and support the resistance. I hold my head up high, and I'm quite proud of them. And to be completely honest, I don't think anything I do is worth the dust on any resistance fighter's sandals. And yeah, I'll never condemn them.
So let's cut to the chase, Indy. Do you believe that Western society is experiencing a collapse? And if so, what causes you to come to that conclusion?
I think it's been collapsing since the 80s, man. Like, you guys haven't had any new movies or anything since then. I think you're running on fumes. Like, well, what the founder of Hamas, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin, said, so he predicted that Israel would end by 2027. And he said any society built on plunder and, like, theft just won't last that long. There's nothing at the center of it to hold it together. And yeah, I think it's collapsing. I think colonialism is like a cancer. It can't sit still. It has to find something new to consume and produce garbage, and has to find something new to conquer, new to take, and new to break. You can't just sit still and like be with your family and relax, like, and be with nature or anything. It just has to keep consuming and growing. And yeah, I think the cancer is killing the host. I think it worked for a while, and I'm glad it's collapsing. Yeah.
I'm an atheist. I make no bones about being an atheist. I've been an atheist my entire adult life. But I have, during the past 2+ years of genocide, spent a lot of time in West Asia, particularly amongst Shia Muslims who are involved in one way or another in resisting Western aggression and their heinous crimes. I have to say that I've become increasingly convinced that even though I'm an atheist, and I guess I could say I'm proud to be one, but although that's not intended in any way, shape, or form as a slight to those who believe in God, but I'm unapologetic about being an atheist. I've also come to believe that the degeneracy we are seeing in Western society may well have something to do with the decline of religion. I do think it's possible to have leaders who are atheists like me and who are committed to humanity and to basic principles of human decency and to the law. But in the West, I can't help but shake this feeling that the grotesque crimes that we're witnessing with total impunity have something to do with a loss of religious faith. I mean, where do you stand on that issue?
If you look at China, right, they're not, I mean, it's Buddhist there, but the government is not necessarily religious. I don't think you need to have religion. I can say, so I'm a Buddhist, and I can say I've felt something in meditation, as in I've felt something bigger than me and something that made me feel good at a time when I was like sad. I felt that. And when I felt that, I felt a connection to people of faith everywhere. So I went and prayed with like Jewish people. If I hear the words of Jesus in church, I feel like my heart quite moved. Now it's Ramadan. Since this genocide started, I've been fasting for Ramadan and reading the Quran, and I can feel it. At the same time, I think my dad was a pretty devout atheist when I was growing up, and yet he had a very strong moral center. I think there is something there. And I think you have to believe in something more than yourself, otherwise it's not satisfying even to yourself. So in Buddhism, the idea is that like the attachment to the self leads to suffering. Whereas in Western society, if you strip religion out of it, there's only attachment to the self. And you don't need the Buddha to tell you that it leads to suffering. If you just think about yourself all the time, if you just think about how can I make more money, how can I get ahead of this person, even if you get there, even if you're the richest man in Babylon, you won't be happy. And if you look at the people at the top, they're obviously like, if you look at the people in the Epstein files, like these are not like happy, well-adjusted people. If you have to do things like that to other people, you're not happy. And faith is a way of connecting to something bigger than yourself. And you can find faith in, the Quran itself says there's no compulsion in religion. But if you think about something bigger than yourself, then I think you suffer less, and then you cause less suffering to other people. Now, I think Eastern religion didn't work on Western people, because I think there's just something about colonialism. Like I said, like we started at the beginning, that trauma of going out and leaving your connections and your family, but then also going out and doing horrible things and being part of something horrible. I think there's like a trauma there. And I think they tried to layer Christianity over that, but there was a deeper problem. And then my wife is a Sanskritist, and but she was studying so people came to India and they sort of learned Sanskrit in order to sort of to push Christianity on people. And that's kind of not the way to do it either. I think religion is about like connection, and there's just something that's disconnecting about colonialism. Yeah, this is an interesting question. I don't think I gave a clear answer. So my friend Benji, what he says is at the heart of White Empire, there's a white hole. There's just like a white hole of sort of like trauma and loss. Mm-hmm. And you try and paper it over with money, or you try and paper it over with possessions, or you try and paper it over with religion. But it never quite goes right because there's just like a deep trauma at the center of colonialism. And I think Ames is there. Yeah, he said no one colonizes innocently. Like, it hurts the colonizer as well. And to be honest, I don't feel great sympathy for the colonizer. But I think God would help them in any facet. I think God would help anybody. I think faith helps anybody. It just helps you get out of yourself, because following yourself, it just leads to suffering.
You know, for some reason, your comments, your response reminded me of Tucker Carlson's recent interview of U.S. Ambassador to the genocidal entity, Mike Huckabee. I don't know if you had an opportunity to watch that, but in one sense, Carlson succeeded, and I commend him for this, in dismembering intellectually Huckabee and getting him to admit on camera that he believes that Israel should just take all of what constitutes greater Israel, so the entire region between the Euphrates and the Nile. He got him to admit to that and really took him apart on a whole range of issues relating to the Israel U.S. relationship. But he kept coming back, Carlson, in this interview, to this notion that white people have a right, as much right as Israel. He kept challenging Huckabee on this, to defend their land from the invader. And the invader, he kept giving the example of Britain. And the invader were the brown and black immigrants in the country who were effectively trying to dispossess the indigenous white population. And this guy throughout the interview, like, he just he's completely divorced Carlson from the reality that his own country, where he considers himself to be indigenous, was founded upon a genocide. Is totally oblivious to that fact, never even contemplates that there's a question out there about what right do the white people have to be in what we call now North America anyways. So I think that fundamentally you're onto something when you say that there's a certain moral rot there that arises from the fact that these so-called nations are built upon genocide, plunder, murder, and the most vicious forms of exploitation. And even people like Tucker Carlson, who seem to be undergoing some kind of an awakening, at least insofar as Israel is concerned, and the aggression of his own government, still can't grasp the fact that they themselves are the invaders in their own country. I don't know if you have anything to add, but I just I'm flummoxed to this very day that a white person can stand here in North America and claim about being dispossessed from his own land. This blows me.
Yeah, that's no. And the funny thing is, if you look at who they call illegal immigrants, so people from Guatemala, people from Mexico, those people are more native than someone like Tucker Carlson, or certainly someone like Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump's mother was an immigrant. I think, yeah. So if you look at American history, like, so their constitution says one of the reasons, or their declaration, one of their complaints to the king was that he wouldn't let them go hard enough on the savage Indians on their frontier. And the frontier of America has kept moving and moving to the point that it's in Mexico. I mean, Mexico used to be Texas and all that, and then it pushes down to like Guatemala. But it's still part of the same, that genocide of the Americas is ongoing. Now, instead of calling them Indians ignorantly, they call them illegal immigrants ignorantly. But those people are more native to the continent than the white people who claim it. But it's like I say, like, you know, there's no one more possessive than a dog that's just stolen something, or someone that's just cut you off in traffic, right? It's that sort of possessiveness. It's the possessiveness of a thief. So a thief feels very entitled to what they just stole, perhaps even more so than someone who had it.
Right. And then, just because they risked imprisonment to get it, I guess. Yeah. Who knows what goes
and
on.
With Tucker Carlson, and with, like, it's such a weird thing, right? Because the Christian Zionist, Jewish Zionist thing is based on, they're both trying to rush God. And then when the Messiah does come, they think, oh, he's going to get you, but not me. So the Christian Zionists think he's going to get the Jews, and they're going to be on the bad side of judgment. And then Jews think they're going to get the Christians. It's this weird, very cynical cynical ideology. And I think for, so with Israel, right, is what Israel is doing is what Canada did. What Israel is doing is what America did, what Australia did. What Jewish people are really trying to test is if they have the final white privilege, which is to commit a genocide and get away with it. And they're actually rightly annoyed that they're not being allowed to get away with it, because the Canadians did get away with it, and the Americans did get away with it, and the Europeans did get away with it. And once you see this stuff happening now, then it turns back and it colors the way you look at history. And you see this, it's genocide all the way down. And actually, I think somewhere unconsciously, I think I felt just the bad juju like around Canada. And that's kind of why I wanted, no offense, but that's why I wanted to like get out. And I have that option. But a lot of my readers are from there. And then the question is, well, okay, what do I do? Like, where do I go back to? What identity do I go back to if I abandon white identity, which I think people should? And the answer is, I don't know. I think that's a very, very tough problem.
Yeah. I've actually undergone a similar trajectory to you. I haven't gone quite as far as you have. My parents emigrated from the south of Greece in the 50s. They were poor. They had not even 1 year of high school education, and they came because the Canadian government was looking for cheap labor, and it didn't want to go outside of Europe to find it. So it went to the poor and second-class citizenry of Europe, namely those in Portugal and Italy and Greece, brought them over at government expense. So my parents came, and my parents talked to me a lot about the trauma of leaving their country and how they did it because their country lay in smoking ruins after not only the Second World War, but the Civil War. And later in life, I've never felt at home here. Never. From the very time that I, as far back as I can recall, I felt like I was a second-class citizen in this country. And of course, what I've experienced is peanuts compared to what indigenous people experienced, what black and brown people experienced in this country. And so I've started, I now have a second home in Greece. I am a Greek citizen and I spend as much time there. And although it is Europe, it's kind of like on the edge of the Western Empire. And I feel closer to the non-Western world living there and certainly more at home. But I haven't gone all the way and abandoned this country completely, because I do have family and friends here to this very day. I must admit that if it wasn't for those family and friends, I would leave here and I wouldn't feel a drop of sorrow. Again, with no offense to our Canadian comrades, do you ever feel any nostalgia for North America now sitting there in Sri Lanka, even, you know, perhaps during the more difficult economic periods you experienced?
No, I loved Montreal. Like I went to McGill and I had a great time there, but I just feel home here. I think there's a connection to land. Obviously land is moving, people do move around, but there's a connection to land, there's a connection to family, to, so a lot of times when Sri Lankans migrate, you leave your parents behind, and then there's just like the ability to be there for your parents. Like I feel very sad when I see, you know, parents who are alone. And for people who have a concept of like filial piety, that's sort of a deep like pain. So do I miss? No. And then I've had like an FBI file since the Biden era, so I can't go back there.
How do you know that way? How did that come to your attention?
Because they went to my sister's office, who's a civilian, completely unrelated to this. I don't think she even like reads me. I mean, we get along, but that's good. She shouldn't. But yeah, so and that essentially is a threat, right? So that's a threat on her job because of what I was writing. And I'm not an American citizen. I have no green card. I have no connection there. And that's under the Biden era. And I'm proud of that. That's the closest I got to an award. I wish they hadn't got my sister involved. But
can I ask you what is, based on their questions, what was it that they were particularly offended?
Oh, gosh. Yeah. If you can wait a minute, I can dig up what they said.
Hold on. I'd be very interested.
But they were basically, they said, like, we think your brother has been, like, radicalized. Hold on, radicalized. Yeah. Okay.
In other words,
I got it.
A sensible human being. So.
Yeah. So, okay, let's see. I recently, can you facilitate a conversation? Where was it? Hold on. Okay. So the fact that we, okay, so someone in Colorado, I think, gave a tip We don't have any reason to believe that Indrajit has said or done anything outside his scope of protected speech. Now, this is weird because, again, I'm a Sri Lankan citizen. Like, what does my speech have to do with you? However, the fact that the tip we received indicates the support of terrorism, the word you were discussing, means we must do our due diligence to assess whether the support is purely in the form of speech or if there's any material support present. As my sister is Indrajit's closest relative in the U.S., which I think is not really like a legal concept, but okay. Yeah.
And then so was this conversation recorded, or she just took notes?
She lawyered up and she got it in writing.
Right.
And they didn't pursue it any further after that. And Trump, for all his sins, has sort of like discombobulated the FBI. And now this sort of speech restriction doesn't apply to just me. This applies to just anybody. If you like the wrong thing on social media, you'd be in as much trouble. At this point, I was a bit out there, but now everybody lives under these speech restrictions. But you can see the attitude of empire, right? The fact that they think that applies to a random, like, Sri Lanka. And you can see the way that the status of, like, brown people in the empire, which is that they're effectively hostages.
Mm-hmm. How would they have known that you had a sister in the United States? Is it possible they're monitoring your communications? Is that something?
No, they wouldn't need to do that, man. Samarjeeva is not a very common name.
Right.
If you meet a Samarjeeva, I'm probably related to them. Except there's one guy, like a weight loss plastic surgeon guy. I think I'm not related to him, but the other ones I'm related to.
Thank God for that.
I might need it someday. We'll see.
Weight loss plastic surgeon. So let's. I'd like to conclude our discussion by raising a question with you, which I think is not discussed nearly enough, and that's the trajectory of this war that we're witnessing today. I personally believe that there is a high risk that the United States or Israel, particularly Israel, is going to nuke Iran. First of all, I don't think anybody should have any illusions about their capability to do such a thing. These people have proven that they have no red lines whatsoever. Their monstrosity knows no limits. Their inhumanity is of unimaginable scope. And they've got the weapons and Iran doesn't. Iran cannot retaliate, at least as far as we know, with its own nuclear strike. The way things are going, as far as I can tell, this war is going very, very badly for Israel and the United States, and it's only going to get worse, recognizing at the same time that they're inflicting horrible suffering on the people of Iran. How do you assess this risk from where you sit? Do you think that there's a very serious risk that Iran is going to be subjected to one or more nuclear strikes?
So I think the empire is already strategically lost. And I think it's different from, say, Vietnam or Afghanistan or other places where they lost, where they were forced out of those countries. In this case, all of their bases in the Middle East have been destroyed and they're not coming back. And if they wanted to build them back, they'd need China's permission. And that's not going to happen. So when I say strategic loss, that whole dynamic of power has changed in the region and in the world, and it's changed already. When you talk about nuclear weapons, in Gaza, the equivalent of, at the time I checked, I think was 8 nuclear weapons have been dropped. It must be up to, say, 10 by now. Mm-hmm. And even in Japan, the United States killed more people with conventional firebombing than with nuclear weapons. Nuclear weapons are a terrible thing, which I must say is why Ayatollah Khomeini said that these are bad and we don't want to have them. Again, they took the moral stance on nuclear weapons. And because they experienced chemical warfare supplied by the Europeans and the Americans to Saddam, because they experienced those things, they took the moral stance and said, this is wrong. At the same time, if that were to happen, God forbid, Iran has dead-hand capability to inflict major damages to the point of cratering the whole global economy. And Nasrallah said that we have a nuke. He said the ammonium nitrate like storage in Haifa, if we hit that, like it goes kaboom. And then later, perhaps getting the idea from him, that happened in Lebanon, unfortunately.
I thought he referred to Hezbollah's ability to strike Dimona, but in any event, the nuclear.
He was talking about the fertilizer, but maybe at another time he said, and they can also strike Dimona, but if you strike a nuclear power plant, it doesn't go boom necessarily.
Right.
And I think the problem is, I think the people around Trump and Trump himself are not aware of how nuclear things work. You could see in the negotiations they didn't understand. But the fact that Iran has this material already means that they can quickly assemble a nuke, or at least a dirty bomb, in like 2 weeks. And under, I have an article called The Islamic Art of War, but under Quranic war, you can respond in proportion to what is done to you, though God does not love aggressors. But if they were to get nuked, they could respond proportionately. So it would be the destruction. There is mutually assured destruction. I think nukes are somewhat fetishized in the West, as in like every movie, the sort of plot is like, well, can we drop a nuke on it? Whether it's like aliens or climate change or whatever, just drop a nuke on it. But you can have, in terms of just destruction, again, in World War II, more destruction was done through non-nuclear means. And Iran has significant non-nuclear, mutually assured destructive capability. If they did it, the one thing that holds me back is I don't think they have any moral compunctions, but it would make all their money go kaboom as well. So I think they're sensitive to that.
Right. Well, you've put me somewhat at ease. I guess maybe I'm overestimating the risk of this happening. But
well, look, one thing I'll say is, since I'm not doing anything, I trust the resistance and what they say. And if they're not worrying about something, I don't worry about it. Right. And obviously, it's a line that they have to walk. And it's a very delicate line. And you can see that they're very careful with escalation for that, well, for many reasons, but also for that reason. But the people I read and talk to don't worry about it in the same way.
Well, whatever the risk may or may not be with respect to a nuclear strike, I think you'll agree that there is a very elevated risk that we're going to experience a global economic crisis because of the restrictions on the flow of oil and gas outside of out of West Asia.
And, yeah, I'm here for it. I'm here for it, even though like we in the South are going to take a hit. But look, if you look at, for a long time, Iran was suffering under sanctions. Now they've said, well, everybody can feel what we feel if you can't move your oil. So, and for a long time, why should only the people who took the moral stance suffer? Now the people who took the immoral stance are suffering too. And they've been very clear. They've been like, you can travel if you kick the American bases off your soil. And if you disconnect from Israel, which are the moral things that everyone should do. Right. So that's why I say it's a strategic victory. They're dictating terms, and I think these are quite reasonable terms.
So in a recent article, you dispensed some advice, having lived through collapse, about how people should prepare for this coming economic crisis, particularly those who are more vulnerable in society. I don't know if you recall what you said in that regard, but
I can tell you my experience. So you don't know what depends on. So when it collapsed, like obviously there was a run on the grocery stores. So, but what we got is like rice and lentils. That was like the gold. And then for us, the main thing is temperature, like heat. So just getting any sort of battery powered fan, that was a lifesaver for putting the kids to sleep. And having some community support, that's very helpful. And knowing how to like grow food, basic stuff. But one thing I would say is, you know, it's like a Noah's Ark situation. You got to start building your ark earlier, because by the time it becomes obvious to everyone, then things are not available. So I would say it's not, I don't know if it's prepping per se, but yeah, you should get the stuff you need in order. You can't depend on, so we learn not to depend on stable electricity grids. People have backup power. We learn not to depend on having fuel all the time. There was a brief, glorious period where even the rich people were riding bicycles around. Now, the country as a whole hasn't learned from that. We haven't invested in public transport or bicycles. Obviously, planning further ahead is better. But planning, if you can start planning now, it doesn't hurt. Worst case, you'd like have a bicycle in a garden.
Mm-hmm. Well, we will conclude by urging our audience to take your words to heart. As someone who's lived through collapse, it probably knows a great deal more about how to deal with it than those of us living in the pampered West. In any case, I really enjoyed our conversation today, Indy. I hope we can have you back on and keep up the fantastic writing. Where can people find your work?
So it's in my name there, Indica, indy.ca.
Okay.
And yeah, thank you for the conversation. Those are some really stretching questions. Thank you. It's my like pleasure. Free therapy.
Yeah. Hopefully it had therapeutic effects. These are big picture issues, but there's so many things I'd like to discuss with you over time. So I would appreciate the opportunity to have another conversation.
Yeah, thank you. I'd love to. I feel very cool. I get to connect with people from like Montreal again. I'm happy about that.
It's a pleasure for us too. So we're signing off today from Sri Lanka and Montreal on March 11th, 2026.